This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Opening those spam emails about male enhancement drugs could be dangerous. My guest Brian Krebs is an investigative journalist and cybersecurity expert whose new book, Spam Nation, explains how spam has become the primary impetus for the development of malicious software, programs that strike computers and through them target our identities, our security, our finances, families, and friends. He helped break the story of the feud between two of the largest sponsors of pharmaceutical spam, a feud he says would forever change the course of the spam industry. Hundreds of documents from the companies were leaked to him. He also spent a few hours in Moscow talking with the head of one of those pharmaceutical spam companies. Krebs is a former Washington Post reporter who now has the website Krebs on Security. In October, the Association of Certified Fraud Examiners gave him the Guardian Award for Vigilance in Reporting. Brian Krebs, welcome back to Fresh Air. So a lot of your book is about the pharma wars, the wars between two really large companies, sorry, call them companies, that were responsible for a lot of the pharmaceutical spam email, including a lot of the erectile dysfunction and penis enhancement emails.
Right.
So explain like how these partnerships work.
Sure. So the way the partnership works is you have the spam affiliate program, and this is just an organization that takes care of all the back office stuff. They handle customer orders, they handle customer service, they handle getting the product from suppliers, and they handle the shipping, and they handle, you know, everything, all the back office stuff. And then there are the spammers, and these folks, their only job is to drive traffic to the websites that are selling whatever that partnership is selling. So if it's male enhancement drugs, or if it's software, or if it's, you know, knockoff handbags or whatever, that's their job, is to get eyeballs to those sites. And that's the partnership in a nutshell.
So how does the money relationship work between those two parts of the partnership?
Yeah, so it's based on commission. So if I'm a spammer and I have a whole bunch of websites that belong to me, which is usually the case, I blast out a lot of spam. If somebody comes to one of these sites in response to something, a spam email I sent out, and makes a purchase, I get about 30 to 50% of whatever their purchase price was.
So you're the spammer now?
I'm the spammer, yeah.
Okay. And so say you're the business end. You know, say you're the end that's like selling the erectile dysfunction drugs.
Right.
So you have, the only money you're paying to the spammer is the commission?
Correct. If somebody makes a $100 purchase, the spammer is going to get probably $35 out of that. The partnership will get about $20, and the rest is overhead. And this is one of the things that I really wanted to address in the book, which is a lot of people, when they think about spam and they think about the things that you can, that are advertised in spam, they have a really hard time understanding whether people actually get something, or if they plunk down their credit card and they buy some drugs, whether they actually get what they ordered. And I found in every case, I mean, I did hundreds of interviews with people who had bought from spam, and they all pretty much got what they were paying for.
Yeah, well, that leads to some really interesting questions. You interviewed a lot of people because you got access to a lot of secret records. You were able to interview people who'd purchased drugs online through these spam email ads. And why did people purchase it this way as opposed to going to their neighborhood pharmacy and buying it there from somebody who they could see and know and trust?
Almost invariably, what I found in talking to these folks was that they bought it for cost reasons. So the thing that drives pharmaceutical spam is the fact that most of us in America, we don't realize this, but we subsidize the rest of the world's consumption of prescription drugs. So in the United States, it's not uncommon for people to pay 3 to 4 or 5 times as much as you would, say, in Europe or anywhere else in the world where they have socialized medicine, right? The government says you can't charge any more than this for this drug. And that's sort of the arbitrage game that these guys are exploiting, the spammers and the partnerships. So when I went to interview folks, I said, you know, what motivated you to buy and ingest pills that you ordered from, you know, dubious marketers? And price invariably was the reason. So I talked to a lot of folks who were out of work. They didn't have insurance. Their insurance didn't cover the drugs they were prescribed. And at the end of the day, you know, they looked at it was a math issue for them. They looked at it and they said, well, I can pay $400 a month for this if I go to Walgreens, or I can pay $100 if I get it from these guys. And that was the primary reason that folks bought from Spam that I talked to.
Were there any consequences?
Yes.
Yeah.
Every buyer that I talked to reported the same experience after ordering from Spam, which was that they got orders of magnitude more spam after giving away their email address to spammers. No surprise there. They also got a lot of phone calls about, you know, a week or two after the drugs arrived in their mailbox. They started getting peppered with calls from India. People asking, hey, you want to renew your prescription? It's almost time to renew your prescription. And they would get these calls every day. And one woman I tracked down via email, she had to change her phone number because they just kept calling her.
So let's get back to the pharma wars, which were the wars between two of the leading purveyors of pharmaceutical spam. And you write about them in your book, Spam Nation. What were these two groups? How are they similar? How are they different?
Right, so there were two. They were two of the largest pharmaceutical spam organizations, and they're actually run by two different individuals, Russian men, who started a company together in 2003, they started a payment processing company, and they got. They worked together for a while, and then had a falling out and went their separate ways. And the one guy stayed on as the head of that payment processor, and the other guy went off and started a what would become the largest pharmaceutical spam organization out there. And so, just to give you a little context of what that means, they incentivized the selling of products through spam, and in doing so, they employed probably most of the biggest virus writers out there and the biggest spammers. And so, not to be outdone, the guy in charge of the payment company decides he's going to start his own competing pharmaceutical spam organization. And to differentiate himself and his program from others, at that point there were probably two dozen operating, he decides he's going to sell prescription drugs that are controlled substances. So this is something that a lot of the partnerships, the spam partnerships, didn't touch because they were concerned about a heavy hand, law enforcement or Visa and MasterCard coming after them. But it actually works for them because a huge percentage of their buyers are these folks looking for controlled substances like oxycodone and tramadol and things like that. At some point, these guys decide the world's not big enough for the both of them, and they start paying law enforcement folks and politicians in Russia to create a criminal case, investigations into each other's operations. Both of them pay hackers to break into each other's networks and steal huge amounts of information about their operations, including years' worth of emails, chat records, banking records, all these things that show how these organizations were set up. And they leak that to law enforcement here in the United States and in Europe, and they leaked it to me.
So you got an extraordinary cache of documents. Tell us a little bit about what you got access to through these leaks.
Right. So one of the most useful things that I got was 4 years' worth of instant message communications between the people running one of these pharmaceutical spam organizations and the spammers themselves. So you can imagine the day-to-day communications between people running huge networks of hacked computers through which they're using to send all this spam, and they're communicating with the people who are paying them to do this. And they would have these yeah, they would have these conversations like, you know, the botnet, the infrastructure's down today. I'm really sorry about that, but you know, we'll be back up in a few minutes. We're sort of, you know, rejiggering the technology side. They would have arguments about you know, commissions, argument about whether the pharmaceutical organization was shaving, they called it shaving, their profits and not paying them for stuff that they delivered. And that was really incredible.
It's so interesting that these two rival pharmaceutical spam organizations leaked the other's stuff. So it was kind of like mutually assured destruction.
It was, and they both destroyed each other. They succeeded in spectacular fashion. Neither of them are around now. One of them was shut down by Russian law enforcement, and the other, the guy running it went to jail.
What happened when they shut down? How did that decrease the amount of spam in the world?
Well, because these guys who were sending the spam were only doing it because somebody was paying them to do it. And when the one spam program shut down, they didn't have anyone paying them to send spam for several weeks. They had to figure out what they were going to do with all their traffic. So they just sort of they put their crime machines in park until they could figure out who else they should benefit from their traffic. And so we saw spam volumes globally dip. I don't know what it was. I think it was 30 or 40% overnight.
And then did they go back up again?
Yeah, of course. As soon as they figure out who best to give their traffic to, yeah, we saw it just pop right back up.
So another link here is that I think both of the rival pharmaceutical spam organizations were involved in pornography too.
Yeah, this was a really interesting dynamic. The two gentlemen that I profile the most in this book I mentioned earlier, they started a business together. They started a credit card processing business in Russia because they were having trouble getting processing for the kind of content that they were selling. And it was, they were running adult webmaster networks, and they catered to, each of them catered to large numbers of individuals who were selling very, very extreme pornography. So the kind of stuff that you might understand why credit card processors wouldn't want to touch that. So much of it was child pornography. Some of it was zoo porn. Some of it was bestiality, rape, snuff type films. And so they really wanted to get credit card processing. They set up their own credit card processing networks. And one of the things that I found was really remarkable is that I sort of liken the porn industry as sort of a gateway drug for cybercrime. Almost universally, when I've done the research to figure out who's who in the cybercrime world, they all got their start pimping pornography in one way or another.
So if you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Krebs, and he runs the website Krebs on Security. He's an expert on cybersecurity. He's a journalist. And his new book is called Spam Nation, the inside story of organized cybercrime from the global epidemic to your front door. And part of what he writes about is the pharmaceutical spam. So, Brian, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk more about cybersecurity and spam. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Brian Krebs. He's a journalist who specializes in cybersecurity issues. He has the website Krebs on Security and is now the author of the new book, Spam Nation. The two rival pharmaceutical spam organizations that you write about in your book, Spam Nation, where were they based?
Both of them were based in Moscow.
And why is Russia a hospitable? Is Russia a hospitable place for spam?
Russia is a very hospitable place for spam for all kinds of cybercrime. A lot of this has to do with the way the former Soviet Union and Russia educated folks. Very strong emphasis on math, science, and technology, and these sorts of things actually lend themselves very well to a career in computing. And so there's a strong community there that grew up around technology and computers, and you know, it brings in, cybercrime brings in a tremendous amount of money to the country, and the government there has, I think, nurtured this industry to some degree. And you know, I think having gone to Russia and really taken in the scene there, people who have never spent any time there have a hard time conceptualizing this. But you walk into a store that sells magazines, you might find dozens of magazines dedicated to hacking and criminal hacking. You just wouldn't see that here in the United States. It's just a totally different culture.
So because they have better math programs than we do, they have more spammers than we do.
Well, no, I mean, I think part of it is you have a community that's grown up around this this industry, and cybercrime is an industry, and you have all kinds of communities that that lend support to individuals who are engaged in this type of activity, and a majority of them happen to be in the Russian language. So, you know, if you want to get started in cybercrime and you're not really sure how to do it, it's never been easier to do that, because there are dozens of forums where you can go and get tutelage. You can get people to help you jumpstart your business. You know, if you don't know how, if you don't understand it, you can sort of learn on the job.
You mentioned one incident in which one of the heads of one of these pharmaceutical spam organizations was being investigated by somebody in the Russian police. Mm. But then the head of this pharmaceutical spam organization basically brought on that guy from the police into the spam organization and paid him a lot more money than the police had been paying him. End of investigation.
Yeah, that sort of died on the vine. Yeah, he hired him as one of his security guys, and he was actually a lawyer, the guy that was investigating him for illegal business activities. And he just said, hey, just come work for me, you know, and you'll make a lot more money. It'll be a lot more fun. So, you know, come to the dark side. We have cookies.
So what is the fate now of the men who headed up the pharmaceutical spam organizations that you write about?
Right. So Vrublevsky went on trial a couple of years ago, and it wasn't for sending spam or anything like that. It was he had paid one of his top spammers to use his crime machine. So we're talking about tens of thousands of hacked computers that they control remotely to attack the website of Russia's largest airline. The company that this pharmaceutical spam executive was running was competing for a credit card processing contract with this airline with several other companies, and he attacked one of the other companies that was in the running for that contract. He had his top spammer knock him offline. And when you do that to a company, so this is something I probably should have mentioned earlier in our conversation when you were asking about why cybercrime in Russia. They sort of don't care what you're doing to the rest of the world, but as soon as you start picking on Russian banks or Russian companies, they care very much. And so he attacked this airline, which was 51% owned by the Russian government. And by the way, it delayed, you know, flights. And, you know, imagine if somebody attacked Washington National Airport. You'd have a lot of politicians would be upset. So that's exactly what happened. And there was a criminal investigation into him. That was a bit of a farce of a trial, as many trials are there in Russia. And he ultimately got sent to prison for a 2-year sentence.
How did the takedown of these two big pharmaceutical spam organizations change the spam industry?
Unfortunately, it really didn't. I mean, any time that something happens to disrupt these operations, you see other types of effects. You see a drop in spam. You see a drop in malicious attacks online. But these are always temporary. The demand side of things, the reason that these pharmaceutical spam and other types of commercial spam industries exist is because there is a strong demand. And some of the researchers that I worked with in this book found that exactly. They said that, you know, it didn't matter what happened to these organizations. Somebody would step in and fill that need. And that's part of the reason I named the book Spam Nation, because I wanted to make it clear that this problem, while we like to say, well, you know, these cyber criminals in Russia and blah, 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 the demand side of things is very much coming from this country.
Brian Krebs, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Brian Krebs is the author of the new book, Spam Nation. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org.